America should be grateful to God for the blessings he's given us.
Don't let anyone tell you that America's best days are behind her.
We have got to fight for this nation because I believe with all my heart this nation is in fact one nation under God.
Let me go to Todd from Michigan. Hey, Todd.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for taking my call and all that you do.
Sure.
Just looking for your wisdom here so I can mull it over. You've always had good wisdom for everyone. So my question is, well, the background to it a little bit is, my wife and I have been discussing, we're in our mid-40s. We're fairly close to paying off our house, probably a year and a half to 2 years. And recently, as of about last year, we have about $250,000 in qualified money. So as of last year or so, I don't know, there was there was a distinct time, you may know, when we changed this, but we now have investing outside of qualified money. Mm-hmm. And cut back the qualified money because I think we're doing very well there. So
yes.
My question is, if I stop putting the money into the outside investment account, I think I could move up. We could move up paying off the house by approximately 6 months, 6 to 8 months. So we're looking at a year to year and a half if we pause the outside investing versus a year and a half to 2 years if I continue doing that. Do you think it'd be a good idea just to pause it and get the house paid off and go from there? Or just because it's not really that big of a time period, that's where I keep going back and forth, just slowly keep going with the outside investment account. Usually I go about every quarter, you know, with something on the buy list because we can build up a couple, $2,000-$3,000, you know, and then I invest it that way.
Right. Yeah, that's a tough one. I probably would do something like maybe throw a little more at it to get it down to a year. But I don't think I would, because you're still earning, you're in a great position, you've got income coming in, a year and a half to 2 years, not a big deal. It means 47, you're paid off, or, you know, 48, 49, doesn't matter, but,
right,
you know, the mortgage is paid off. So I think that's going to put you in a very good position to ramp up dramatically your input into your investment strategy. And I'd rather you wait. I wouldn't get too carried away. I don't think there's any real benefit. I mean, if the market turned down dramatically in the next, 6 months, and you say, hey, you know what, I just want to get the house paid for, and you wanted to try to do something differently, you can. I mean, but, you know, the money you're putting in your investment account's going to be there. If something happened in an emergency kind of way and you wanted to pay your house off, you'd probably be able to do it. So I just wouldn't be that concerned. I think you're smart continuing what you're doing. You're doing a great job. You're doing the right thing by switching over to this investment account, focusing on that, because that's going to give you so much flexibility. I think you're doing everything right. I probably wouldn't change anything.
Right.
All right, Todd. You're on the right track, man.
Well.
You're gonna be in great shape someday. Keep plugging.
All right. Thank you, sir.
All right.
Bye.
God bless. Thanks. Randy is on social media, on Facebook, is asking, said, I'm meeting with a financial advisor about what to do with my lump sum payment from my old employer. Suggestions. Well, the suggestion from the financial advisor is to put all of it, most of it, or some of it for sure, in an annuity. I can guarantee you that. So I can already tell you that. My advice to you, my suggestion was, don't do that. I think it'd be a mistake, but it'll sound very good to you. And you'll get in the car when you leave and say, well, I don't know, it's kind of a no-brainer. I got to do that. It's interesting. I was talking to somebody that I was with last week, and they said, man, did you call that right? Because I've been in one for 3 years and haven't made a nickel, but my contract value on my thing goes up. But I got to stay in 11 years, and even then I don't get it as cash. I've got to use it to annuitize. I mean, it's amazing what happens. It is not the thing you should do. You shouldn't be doing that, Randy. You can do that if you want. my suggestion to you would be to tell your financial advisor that you want to be in individual stocks, all producing dividends, and you want to actually take the dividends. You may not need the dividends. Take them anyway. Don't reinvest. Take the dividends. Individual stocks. You should have 50 stocks when you're all said and done. I don't know how much money you're getting, but 40 to 50 stocks when it's all said and done. All of them producing income. And with that, you should be able to easily produce a 4.5% to 5.5% income every year. Or if you want to be a little bit more aggressive, I don't know how old you are, you could probably get up to 6.5%. I got people calling me saying they're making 7-8% on their income portfolio. So I would, that's what I would suggest, but he's not going to do that or she's not going to do that. But that would be my suggestion. Let's see how much time we got. Let me go to Rob. Rob calling us from Arkansas. Hey, Rob.
Hey, I hope you had a good time with your trip there.
I did.
You make me kind of jealous because I saw the picture on Facebook with you and Mike Huckabee.
Oh, yeah, and, right. Right.
That's one of the guys that I'd like to meet one of these days. But
yeah.
At any rate, what I wanted to comment to you about was the segments that you had last week while you were gone about, you know, between socialism, capitalism,
yes.
capitalism,
yes.
And all the other segments. Dude, I cannot tell you how much I thank you for that, because even though I was on the road in my big truck and I was able to record it on my computer at home, when I got home in the evening, I shared that with my family, and my 15-year-old found it very fascinating, especially with capitalism and socialism, because he didn't really know the difference. And he's taken economics in high school right now, and so he was just trying to grasp that, and he was just really appreciative of it.
Wow.
And so I just I got to hand it to you. You're phenomenal at the work that the Lord has given you to do.
Mm. You know, that is very, very encouraging. I thank you for sharing that with me, Rob. And, you know, I'm so glad your 15-year-old listened to that attentively. And we're going to break that down. We're going to take those segments so that we can separate them, if we haven't already, on the website and package them up there on the website so that people can listen to those they're on the app, broken down already, I guess, on the Financial Issues phone app. So that's
and
great.
That was one of the next things I was going to be asking you, was because once you get all that done, I'd like to apply that to biblical values, because I'm a teacher at church.
Yes.
And I'd like to apply that to biblical values to the members of our church and bring that up once in a while and just show them. And one of the other comments I wanted to make was I enjoyed the interview with Robert Spalding.
Yes.
I am totally 100% on board with that guy, and especially what you said. I don't think they're going to move before 2020, and the reason is because the fake polls that they've said that President Trump is starting to fail.
Yeah.
That's what they're holding their beliefs on, and I think they're going to hold out until the election to see if they're actually going to get a Democrat in there so they don't have to move on anything.
Yeah, and I'll tell you something. After that, it's going to be too late for them. They're going to be out of luck. They've missed a golden opportunity to get a deal, and after 2020 elections, if they think they're going to get any kind of decent deal, they're living in a fantasy world. So I agree. And again, I hope more than anything, and he's right there in the heart of Washington. He is in the administration. He's doing work for the administration and the Department of State and everybody else. And I feel good when I hear him say that behind the scenes, there's probably a lot of negotiation going on with the European Union. And man, I hope that someday, in, you know, one week, we just have it all unveiled to us, and we have all these deals with the Eurozone. And I hope he is absolutely right about that, because I'll tell you, that is going to take everything to a new level and put an enormous amount of pressure on China as well. And then we can sit back and say, you know what, we don't need China. We don't need China. We need Mexico far more than we need China. I mean, from who we export to, and you know, we'll be fine. Thank you for that, Rob. You sure have encouraged me this morning. I sure do appreciate
Thanks,
you. Thank
God.
You for that. God bless you.
God
Thank
bless.
You. Thank you. Great stuff, folks. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back, Financial Issues. I'm Dan Tsuya. Just speaking about what we were just talking about last segment in the first hour, we have with us Robert Spalding. He is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, and he has done some amazing work. He focuses on U.S.-China relations, economy, national security, and Asia-Pacific military balance. He served in senior positions of strategy with the State Department, Department of Defense, and other departments for more than 26 years. And we sure do appreciate him. He is senior director for strategy to the president. And we sure appreciate his work and what he's been doing. And I don't think anybody knows U.S.-Asia issues better than him. And we have so much going on as a result of U.S.-China trade. And I'm concerned, as I mentioned in the last segment, I am concerned about what is going on in Hong Kong. Robert, welcome. Thank you for being on the program.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So, you know, we're watching the protest over the weekend, and thankfully they've remained calm and peaceful, and certainly a good thing with Hong Kong and China. But there doesn't seem to be any let up, though they are a little bit quieter over the course of a week, probably a million people protesting. And I'm just, what is going on in Hong Kong, is that beginning to fuel some real concerns in the Chinese economy and how that might affect our trade talks?
Well, certainly it's not having an effect yet on the Chinese economy, but could potentially have a big effect on the economy, particularly if they use violence to suppress the protest. And so if they do, then that will signal that the Communist Party no longer supports a one country, two systems. And it's likely that the United States is going to remove the special relationship that Hong Kong has had, which really allows it to be a window to Western capital markets for China. And so I think going forward, it could be very potentially economically damaging. I think right now the concern for them is can they stop these protests before they have the potential for essentially getting support in the mainland. Right now it doesn't appear that that's the case, but it could be that it spreads.
So, and I hope, you know, the last thing I think that China would want to have is to see that, not that they would be, you know, maybe if we weren't in the trade negotiations that we're potentially in, if we can call them that, with China, maybe they wouldn't be as reluctant to sit back and wait and see, but hopefully they'll stay that way for a while. But if we did what you said and cut Hong Kong off, would that be looked at as taking sides with China?
No, it would actually be, there's not really a side to take in that case. Maybe you could make the argument that you're taking the side of the protesters, but essentially the special relationship was based on the one country, two systems policy, where essentially China said that they were going to allow Hong Kong a level of autonomy. You know, of course, they've been encroaching on that autonomy for quite a while, you know, with forcing the elected officials there to actually be approved by Beijing prior to going through elections. So in actuality, the people aren't allowed to pick their representatives, which is one of the things that they're protesting against right now. So I don't think it's necessarily it would signal that we are taking one side or the other, but could be interpreted that we were taking the protesters' side.
Mm. Could this escalate to having an impact on U.S.-China trade or not, since we aren't taking any sides or just letting this play out a little bit.
It is already, I think, from the side of the, from in the eyes of the Communist Party, it is having an impact on trade because there's no chance of them coming to any kind of negotiation with regard to trade as long as these protests are going on, because they actually believe that we, the United States, are responsible for fomenting the protests. You know, that it's very difficult for them to believe that this could, you know, generate spontaneously from the Hong Kong people themselves. They always, you know, see the black hand of the United States involved in trying to overthrow the Communist Party. And so since that's their view, the likelihood of us having any kind of trade agreement while these protests are going on, regardless of, you know, this dispute on the negotiated 150-page document, really is not anywhere in the cards.
Yeah. So could this escalate to the people in China? I mean, could, I know the communist regime controls the media, but could it escalate? Could, I mean, certainly the Chinese people are hearing about it.
Yeah, I think the likelihood of that happening actually increases if China's economy continues to slow. One of the ways that they've kept people in check and to include, you know, increasing the People's Armed Police. So they have literally millions in the People's Armed Police, plus they have, you know, I think by 2022, they're supposed to have one camera for every two people in the country by that time, plus just all the data that they have from all the WeChat traffic that goes on. They essentially have automated the ability to control the society down to the level of the individual. So right now, it appears they have everything firmly in hand. But, you know, appearances can be deceiving, particularly if the economy continues to slow. If it continues to slow, then people are going to become more and more agitated as unemployment rises. They're kind of getting hit doubly right now because of unemployment due to supply chains moving out of China, and at the same time they've got a pork issue and a corn issue with the armyworm and the swine flu. So they've got spiking prices in food, and then they've got increasing unemployment for some of their manufacturing industries. So it's a big problem.
Well, and the bigger problem as I see it, and I've been saying this for a long time, and I've been wrong for a long time, because for a long time I've said, you know, at some point in time, China has to come to the table and get this done, because, not because they care desperately about making sure their people are all working, although they do, they want to stay in power. But at the same time, they're losing market share. I mean, there's an exit, you know, I wouldn't say a mass exodus, but there's a lot of companies that are going to be headed, and already have over the last 3 years, to Vietnam, and they're going to be going to Indonesia and the Philippines and other places. And they're not going to get that back. And, you know, to lose something for a company like that, as precious as manufacturing, when that's pretty much all they have, isn't that, I just find it amazing that that hasn't been enough to keep them negotiating in good faith.
Yeah, I think people, so after 2008, they relied heavily on their state-owned enterprises to essentially keep them out of a recession. And ever since, they've been strengthening the role of the state-owned enterprises in their economy. So I think they actually had a calculated decision to say, we're going to try to get a new president in 2020, and barring that, if we fail at that, we believe that we can be self-sufficient enough with our state-owned enterprises that we can decouple our economy from the United States. I think that's the decision they've made, and which is why I don't expect a trade deal before 2020, and I think that they realize that if President Trump gets reelected, he's going to be even harder on them. So I think they've made a calculated decision, essentially, to decouple their economy, because they think that they can control the Eurasian landmass through the Belt and Road Initiative and Made in China 2025.
I agree with that 100%, and that's what I've been I've kind of pivoted to, that there's not going to be a trade deal. I don't think it's going to happen, and maybe they feel like they can manipulate the election somehow. But that aside, don't you think, and this is my frustration, don't you think that it's probably more critical than ever that we pivot to the Eurozone and start looking at getting good, solid trade deals, even if it's nation by nation in the Eurozone? And, you know.
Yeah, and I think what's been going on quietly behind the scenes is just exactly that. Mm. So we're having bilateral negotiations with a lot of our allies and partners around the world to say, hey, we need to essentially create a democracy-only economic zone. And to the extent that you're reliant on our security relationship for your protection, then you need to think really hard about, you know, how you align your finance, economy, trade, and investment with the United States.
You know, I just got back last week from the Baltics and you know, talking to so many people throughout the nations there. And, you know, they're so... I was surprised at how supportive they were about so many issues that are going on here with American politics, and are you know, understand what we're going through with China, and hopefully we can start negotiating some good deals with them, and that would be. And I hope you're right about behind the scenes and quietly negotiating those deals, because we sure need that.
Yeah, and I think most of those countries recognize that, you know, if you go back to the Atlantic Charter, which was really the kind of the principal template for the international order after World War II, mm-hmm. you know, the four things that it talked about were free trade, democratic principles, rule of law, and self-determination. And I think, if America doesn't stand up for those things, then it's going to be very hard for these smaller nations that are less powerful economically and militarily to do so. So they're actually looking the United States to take the lead on that. And so for since the end of the Cold War, we've essentially abandoned that for this belief that open markets lead to wealth and wealth leads to democracy. And we have to get back to it. And that's what we actually wrote into the National Security Strategy, just to focus on getting back to the basics of what we believe as a country. Mm. Free trade and democratic principles actually go together.
Well, I agree 100%. Hopefully we can get back to that and stick with that. And that'll continue to happen. Robert Spalding, a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, we appreciate you so much, your work. Thank you for being a part of the program. We'd love to have you back, and we'll see how things progress. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
All right. Welcome back, Financial Issues. I'm Dan Celia. It is great to be here. By the way, I was talking about payroll tax. That was a great interview with Robert Spalding, and I appreciate him. Gives you a little bit of a feel for what's going on and why it's going on or what's happening. He, like me, agrees that there's not going to be a trade deal with China. It's not going to happen. If you get a chance to listen or hear my two-minute commentary that I do every day on maybe one of the stations you're listening to, it's on thousands of stations around the country every day, but maybe you get to hear that, and maybe it's on a specific show you listen to or whatever. But I talked about this morning probably at length, my two-minute commentary, but talk about this whole idea with China and trade and what is going on with currency and devaluation and Fed cuts and all those kinds of things. But we're talking about payroll tax before that interview that we took. And I want to get to phones, 610-363-1110, 610-363-1110, if you want to queue your call. But let me just say this. I don't think it's a good idea. I mean, I don't think we should be even talking about cutting payroll tax. The president thinks this is going to be a boost to the economy. It's going to help the markets. It's going to help the economy. Look, the economy is doing just fine, thank you. There's nothing wrong with the economy. And I don't know, maybe the president doesn't even realize that, but there's nothing wrong with the economy. Maybe the president wants to do this in anticipation of something going wrong in the economy. If anything goes wrong in the economy, it's going to be the negativity coming out of media first and foremost. It's going to be because of trade deals that can't get worked out. We can fix that in a heartbeat. The president, if he's worried about getting reelected in the midst of a recession, He doesn't have to worry. I can give him all the president. Pick the phone up. I can promise you, guarantee you, without a shadow of a doubt, I am 100% certain I can guarantee that you can move in a certain direction. I'm not going to say what it is. You could move in a certain direction, and I can guarantee your reelection. Forget about what the economy's doing. I can guarantee your reelection. Forget about we're in a recession. I can guarantee your reelection. I'm not saying it because I want the president to call me. He doesn't listen to this. He's not going to call me. I know that. I hope not. I got enough to do. But look, it's not that hard to figure out what we've got to do. But let me just tell you about the payroll tax. You want to do something positive? How about if you want to cut payroll tax, how about you say, all right, we're going to cut payroll tax for the sole purpose of whatever we are, instead of cutting the payroll tax, instead of reducing your payroll tax to you as a consumer, we're going to do something for your children and your grandchildren. And we are going to, instead of making an actual physical cut, we are going to make a designation that X amount of percentage, whatever they were planning on cutting payroll tax, say they were planning on cutting payroll tax 10%, we are going to make a designation that 10% is going to go to pay down the American debt. How about that? You think that's not going to make the American people start feeling good? You think that's not going to have a lasting impact? All these cuts in taxes, all the growth in the economy, All of it, not some of it, all of it is worthless if we aren't at the very same time doing something to cut the size of government and to cut government spending. If we aren't doing that at the same time, nothing is going to happen good. I know that all of Congress, all of the executive branch of the government, Secretary of Treasury, Commerce, everybody else, believes that the answer to all our problems is growth. I would say that we cannot get any answers to any of our problems in the economy and anything else without pro-growth. It's definitely a key component of what has to happen, but it is a component that in and of itself is not going to solve some of the complexities and problems that we have in our economy, namely debt. We can't solve the debt problem unless we can guarantee somehow, way, shape, and form a 7% GDP growth for the next 4 years in a row. There is no way we're going to do it with growth alone. We've got to have a pro-growth administration, which we already have, that is focused on cutting the debt. It isn't any more complicated than that. Cutting the size of government. Why must we do everything possible to gain more government control, to create bigger and larger governments? The only president that I can remember that seemed to understand that in recent history has been Ronald Reagan. You know, the old thing that he used to say, the worst thing we could ever hear is, I'm the government and I'm here to help. It can't happen that way. And Ronald Reagan believed and knew that the government was not an answer to all our problems, though they had to do some things like fiscal responsibility, but they weren't the answer to all of our problems. As a matter of fact, the more intrusive government got, the worse things got. We have got to be thinking about the economy is good, how are we going to keep it that way? And I can tell you how we're going to keep it that way. First and foremost, number one, the easiest thing to do is come up with good trade deals. Not tell France we don't want any of your cars. Tell France we want a trade deal. Let's do it. Go to Germany, say we want a trade deal. Let's put it together. A good trade deal, just something even. I remember the car manufacturers in Germany a year ago said we should just have free trade. No tariffs, just free trade. Well, they're right. That's what we should do. We've got a government now, Commerce Department, so focused on China, they can't think of anything. They go to bed at night thinking about China. They wake up in the morning thinking about China. Let's forget about China. Let's move on. My word. China is going to keep talking until after November of 2020. They're trying to buy time. We think they're worried about their pride and saving face. We think that surely their people, they're going to want to feed their people. They don't care about that. They don't care about human rights. It's not in their DNA. It's not something they're worried about. All they're going to do is continue to print money. They're going to collapse the world in the currency with all the money they're printing. They're going to make the Iraqi dinara seem like the most strongest currency in the world. I'm telling you, it's ridiculous. And they print. They have no choice. All of their banking system pretty much now is controlled by the government. We're watching Germany, second largest bank in the world, Commerce Bank in Germany, in the largest economy in the Eurozone, closing branches, closing banks. They're in big trouble. They don't have the luxury that Deutsche Bank has right now by forming a bad bank and putting all their bad debts into the bad bank. As if that makes the bad debts go away. As if that makes bad debt off, takes bad debt off the back of taxpayers. No, it just shifts them over from one balance sheet to another. It's smoke and mirrors. We've got real problems in the global economy. We have real problems in the markets here, in the economy here. And the notion that we ought to be cutting federal rates in order to prop up the markets, oh, the markets are going to go up. Who cares what the markets do? Let's just worry about the economy and the markets will take care of themselves. How long have I been saying that? That's what we should be focused on, not the markets. We don't need false positives in the market because we have a bunch of people on Wall Street that are so used to drinking that Kool-Aid of cheap money that they've been drinking for the last 10 years, last 12 years. They don't want it to ever end. So let's use up all our dry powder. What's wrong with maintaining ourselves as the shining city on the hill? What's so wrong with that? Why do we have to follow everybody else over the cliff? Why do we want to do that? What's wrong with having the strongest currency in the world? What's wrong with having a yield that is the only yield in the world that doesn't start with 0 point something? At least we have a whole number first before we get to that point. We're the only ones that do. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with having the whole world wanting to invest in America? What's wrong with that? I don't know. I like being number one. I don't see a need for America to have some sort of race to the bottom. I don't understand that mentality. I don't think we need to trash the dollar. We need to keep it the way it is. It's strong. People love it. They want to come here. They want to invest here. What's going to happen with all these cheap interest rates when we can't sell any of our debt? What happens when the Federal Reserve's balance sheet all of a sudden hits, you know, $12, $13 trillion? What is the difference between that and us having $12, $13 trillion of debt? It becomes nothing more than more smoke and mirrors of moving some debt from our balance sheet to their balance sheet. It doesn't get rid of it. It doesn't do anything for it. And allows us to keep printing money, and that's not good for our currency. Let's not go down that road. Why are we so insistent on doing it? All right, I promise. I'm on calls right after this. We'll be right back.
The opinions and recommendations expressed by Dan are his own and do not necessarily represent the opinions of this station or any of the show's sponsors.
So just real quick, Julie giving us another coachable moment I don't want to let go by. And just always keep in mind, people say, I don't get these calls much anymore because people have been listening for so long and so on and so forth. But look, people used to call and they would say, I need to get income. I need to get more income. I need to get more income than I'm getting in CDs. But I don't want to take a lot of risk. What can I do to get more income without a lot of risk? There is nothing. Now, if you say that, now, if Julie were to say that with her representative, he's going to immediately point to an annuity, and that person, he or she, will lay out a wonderful case why that's not risky. Now, you can believe that if you want. That's up to you. It all sounds very good, and so on and so forth. You know, I was away yesterday, and last week, and there were a group of people there, and somebody came up to me, and they were, I was speaking one night. And after I was done speaking, this couple came up to me and they were telling me about something they did. And I just felt them, I just felt in my heart that they were feeling very down on themselves for putting all this money into an annuity that was now, that hadn't gained anything in 3 years. And they wanted to get out and they were feeling, I could tell they were just feeling. And I said to them, when we were done talking, I said, look, whatever you do, understand that you going into this product was something you did because of what you heard. And anybody in their right mind hearing that portrayed in a believable way would have believed it and probably would have done the same thing. So don't go down on yourself for doing it. You can get down on the person that was putting out that very well-crafted deception. You can get down on that person. But don't get down on yourself because you only did what was computing in your brain. It was all making sense to you. And that's why I say most of the time, it's not the product of the annuity in and of itself that I dislike so much. It's the way they're sold that I dislike so much. And I am telling you folks, this is a red flag alarm. There are flares flying in the air over these interest rates crashing that we are seeing every single day. Mortgage rates down again. We see interest rates lower and lower. Your bank interest rate down lower, and if it can get any lower. We are seeing this. And there is going to be a full court press, an all-out advancement on a particular type of selling, and it's called interest rate selling. They're going to go after your heart and mind with interest rates because you all understand that a CD, you put $10,000 in, you get 4%. That's a great thing. You get that. You understand it. So the tactics are that they're going to interest rate sell. And they're going to say, how much are you getting on your money market account? I'm not getting anything. Exactly. How much are you getting your CD? Well, I'm getting 1.5%. Exactly. Let me tell you how you can get 4%. And they go on to explain that. Or 5% or 6%. They don't have to say 6% anymore. They don't have to say 5%. They say 4% and still get away with interest rate selling. And chances are you immediately are going to gravitate towards the product before they've even finished their spiel. They know that. But you listen to Financial Issues. And it's why they hate me so much. So you listen to this program. I've got nothing to gain. I'm not selling you anything. I don't say, well, wait a minute, I got a better problem. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying, hey, you know what? If you buy my book, I'm not saying that either. As a matter of fact, I told somebody today, I only had one person so far today ask me about being a partner. I told him not to do it. I want God's people to do what's right with God's money. I want you to be a good steward of what God has given you. I don't want you to continue. I don't want you to make mistakes. I don't want you to, I don't even want you to have to think about the process. you know, is this good judgment or is this poor? Am I being, I'm just telling you, I've got nothing to gain. The only thing I've got to gain is maybe a blessing of God for helping God's people. That's all I want to try to do. So I hope that you'll pay attention to these things. But another very coachable moment. There is no higher return without higher risk. They go hand in hand. That's why I always say the kiss of death in a portfolio is when somebody says, well, I've gotten clobbered. I just got started 3 years ago and the markets hurt me and I got to make it up. Worst thing anybody could say to me, because I know in my heart they're destined to make a huge mistake because they are opening themselves up to some very aggressive, very volatile, very bad situation because all they're thinking about is I got to make up time. I got to make it up. I got to make it up. So no return, no higher return without a little bit of higher risk. You don't have to take a dramatic. You can get 2% without taking dramatic risk, but there's still going to be a risk of loss. If you're entering into any product that's got anything to do whatsoever with the market. So keep that in mind. All right, Donna from Ohio. Hi, Donna.
Hi, Dan. I had a couple questions for you.
Okay.
I rolled over to an IRA, a little over $90,000, and I was wondering what would be the best to invest it in. I'm going to be 60 next year, and I'm planning on quitting my job and then just staying home and taking care of the family. So my husband will be working for like another 4 years.
Okay.
So we won't be touching it for like probably about at least four years.
Okay. Yeah, I would probably look at investing, 45,000 of that, give or take. You know, put it into some very conservative position, still risky but conservative. Some good solid utility companies that are mid cap to large cap companies that are producing income, maybe a 3.5-4.5% dividend, somewhere in that range every year, but still have opportunity for some growth. That would be a good option for some of those investments. Possibly a good option might be some very large cap solid companies that again are paying good dividends, but have opportunity for growth, and that might be some options too. I would only do it with about half the money, because for half the money, you can consider 45,000 of that long-term money, because you still got another half that you could begin to use a little bit of if you needed to. In the meantime, the other half that you're not investing is going to grow because the dividends and the income being produced by the half that's invested is going to go into your money market account and grow that other half. Now, I would at least on that other half put it into CDs, and I wouldn't have a problem putting all of it into a 2-year CD or a 2 or 3 year CD or somewhere in between. I mean, I think that would be fine. That would give you a little bit more growth in that. And you could do that from the same account that you're doing some of these other kinds of investments.
We are members. Do you have any?
Yeah. So if you're a partner, I would tell you to take a look at the utilities that are on my buy list. There's not many, but I would take a look at those first. That would be my first priority. And I would look in the material section of material and industrial section and put a little bit in some of the yellow, those yellow stocks that are highlighted in yellow, they're those good solid company I was telling you about companies, and they're paying a little bit of dividends. And I would also put maybe 10,000 or so into a that ETF that is TPHD. That is the ETF number two, TPHD, that you would put maybe some of that money into as well. I think that would be a great place to go. And then whatever your brokerage account is, say it's TD Ameritrade or Fidelity or whatever it might be, you can buy CDs through them to put in the account as well.
Okay. And I had another question.
Sure.
My husband, he's planning on retiring in like 4 years. And his company has his 401k through AmeriFunds, I believe it is. He's got probably over $400,000 in it. What would be a good place for him to invest that in that?
Now or 4 years from now?
Right now, yeah. While he's got it in.
Yeah, I would be very conservative. I would find out what their most conservative funds are. That's an annuity. That's an assurance company. So that's a kind of an annuity contract. But they probably have some options that he can put it in. And I would want to put it into something that is fixed income or a government bond fund, something that's going to preserve the principal, continue to contribute as much as he possibly can every year. But I would do it in a conservative way to begin to preserve the principal, preparing for 4 years from now when you're going to move that and roll it into an IRA. I think that would be the best way to go. I got to run. I'm sorry, Donna. I hope that's helped you. Folks, we're going to have more financial issues right after this break. We'll be back.
If we ever forget that we're one nation under God, then we will be a nation gone under.